Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Andy Lipson, and today we have guest host Kenny Zepeda, who is joining us because Eduardo is in Spain or France. I'm not sure which. Yeah. And we were supposed to have an episode today about interviewing possibly a French yellow vest, but Eduardo could not pull that together. Or he's having some issues over there in France. Initially, I had contacted you about maybe doing an episode.
Yeah.
And we were like, I don't think we have anything to do.
Yeah.
And then something happened on January 1st.
Yeah.
Which was?
The U.S. Drone strike killed a top Iranian general. Qasem Soleimani.
Soleimani.
Yeah, I'm saying it in Spanish.
Yes. and I think it wasn't even a drone. I actually think it was a helicopter strike.
Okay.
I've heard it's a helicopter. I thought it was a drone strike at first, but I think the U.S. actually brought an airstrike on him directly with helicopters, Apache helicopters, and it happened in the Iraq Baghdad airport.
I mean, I've seen some of the images of the aftermath, and it does seem very precise. It's not, like carpet bombing. It's like a very precise strike.
Right. And so I contacted you yesterday and said, let's go ahead and do an episode.
Yeah.
And honestly, there's already been people talking about it, and it's a big deal, what's happened. And what I said to Kenny was, let's just talk about it on camera. And now, normally with me and Eduardo, it's sort of, he has a more reformist view, and I'm coming from the vantage point of what I consider like socialist revolutionary. Here today, we have two people who consider themselves socialists, revolutionaries, so we're not going to really discuss it from that vantage point, I think, but I did think this raises a lot of questions for you. It raises some questions for me about what the heck the U.S. is doing.
Yeah.
What does this mean? So I figured we'd just talk about it here.
I mean, I definitely have a lot of questions that are becoming maybe a little clearer. I think that, it's a good, just want to address, raise those questions and see where we go from there.
Maybe my first question is, what are some of your thoughts about what's just happened?
I mean, I was in shock. The first reaction was shock. Actually, a coworker texted me the link to the AP press within the first 15 minutes of being reported. I immediately was, whoa, that's very ballsy, to pull something like that. Because I don't know the structure of power in Iran, but hearing that, this is a top commander.
Yeah.
Of the Irani military can definitely throw a wrench into whatever is happening.
He was the head of the Quds, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Quds forces, which are responsible, which I, as I understand it, are paramilitary groups. I do think they operate within Iran, but also he is responsible for overseeing Iranian paramilitary forces in Iraq.
Yeah.
Hezbollah, Hamas, and within the and forces within Syria as well.
Yeah, and my understanding too is that group was placed in the terrorist watch list last year. Actually, the thing.
Yes. Yes. It's also the group that there's a lot of inter-imperial mess here because it's also the group that was that allied itself with the United States in going after ISIS, and actually it was. Qasem's forces or Soleimani's forces, Iranian forces here, were considered fundamental in basically the U.S. Getting back control of what they said ISIS's control of Iraq and Syria.
Northern Syria?
All of Syria.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe mostly Iraq, but also within Syria where they had made much headway. And Soleimani has been allied with the United States around going after the Taliban during the war in Afghanistan. And he was also a general in a war between Iran and Iraq back in the 80s. And now in that war, the United States had played the role of basically pitting two of them against each other. They had just lost power in the 70s. And so they were trying to use Iraq and get Iraq to go after Iran in a war that killed at least 1 million people. It's speculated. And the U.S. basically sided mostly with Iraq, but wanted the war to drain Iran and as punishment for the revolution that they had in taking down the Shah.
Yeah, I mean, one of the questions that came up right away, and I guess this is part of being kind of, I guess, socialist revolutionaries, of asking, you know, not taking the news at face value. Obviously, the U.S. media will fall in line behind the war machine, and so I started questioning what is really happening behind this. So I mean, one of the things that confuses me is that, you know, this whole somewhat, you know, the divide of the ruling class in the U.S., the wrestling of, you know, the proxy war against Russia, proxy war against China, and so this, to me, at least on the surface, it seems to kind of maybe go not fall in line with that right away. I don't know if you have any thoughts, because here is, you know, a Republican president, right, like that tried to pull out, at least symbolically, from the region, right, from northern Syria, and, you know, he received a lot of blowback from that,
right,
you know, from Democrats who basically were championing the U.S. as the police of the world.
Right, and they were also criticizing him for even talking about partially pulling out of Afghanistan, trying to reach a deal with the Taliban, things like that.
Yeah. So, again, on the surface, this seems like an escalation that can potentially unravel a lot of things. I mean, we can address whether, you know, we expect something from the Iranian government. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I don't know if you have any thoughts in terms of if this is in line, or what are your thoughts? Why is this happening?
Yeah. I do think that's the big question. I mean, or one of the big questions for me. And first off, I guess what I would say is prior to this, there had been a lot of criticism of Trump for supposedly weakening the United States by pulling out of, and the establishment, and I believe the establishment was using things like the Mueller probe, Russiagate, and impeachment to force Trump's hand into taking a firmer line with Russia. They were accusing him of being a Putin ally, accusing him of undermining the Ukrainian government, which they were using as a proxy to fight the Russians. And I had seen Trump as largely pivoting away from Russia moving more towards war with China or conflict with China. This act is definitely an escalation in my mind, definitely an escalation, but it's an escalation in the direction, not just of the U.S. and the Middle East, but the U.S. taking on Russia, because Iran is a major ally of Russia, and a major ally of their, of helping Russia push its interests in that region. Mm-hmm. So to me, this runs directly counter to some of the things that Trump is doing. So it is confusing. The way I've been looking at it is, I do think it shows that Ukraine Gate and Russia Gate have actually been successful at. One of the questions I posed to my partner was, who did this? Was this Trump, or was this the establishment? No. Who was behind this attack? And it is dangerous, and it does. It just. I think you use the word shock. I think we haven't seen as big an event since the day of shock and awe. That true. U.S. attacked Iraq in 2003.
Great that you bring that up, because honestly, that is where my mind went to. I mean, I was a high school student, freshman in high school, and it brought me back to that moment.
Yeah.
You know, when we started seeing bombings on TV, and, you know, and this tension. You know, it's among my coworkers, the young ones that are in college, they joke around getting drafted, and, you know, and so this brings up, that time of shock and awe.
And I think it was intended to do that. I do think the U.S. So my answer to this is that this is the establishment behind this. But it is the establishment that is, in a sense, fusing itself with what I think the Trump represents, which is moving away from multilateralism moving more towards U.S. goes it alone. And the breakup of the multilateral world. which is always a myth under capitalism anyway, because it's not a multilateral world. It's a group of nations in competition with one another. But that myth is being exploded, and countries, and every time it gets exploded, it leads to global war, world wars. And this is the period this is where I think these things are headed. So I do think that Trump has convinced the establishment that the U.S. must go it alone, screw NATO. And at the same time, I do see that the establishment has gotten Trump to not pivot away from Russia, to not pivot out of the Middle East, because I personally can't see this move draws the U.S. more into the Middle East, not less.
I definitely agree with that. And I mean, even when I think about the approach to China, it hasn't been a military approach. It's been like an economic, you know, trade war and this and that.
And the powers that the U.S. is going to rely on Germany here. The U.S. isn't going to rely on France to carry water for this. They're going to rely on Saudi Arabia and Israel, which are the two powers that they did check in with about, hey, we're about to do this. Believe it or not, I heard that they even checked in with the Iraqi government prior to this, and their Iraqi government was like, don't do this, you know. And they went ahead and did it. Because the question for me, though, is this the U.S. essentially lighting a match in the Middle East and then just leaving, you know, like, all right, peace out, and throwing a match into the oil, you know, behind them as they leave, and let Russia, the NATO, and them deal with the burn that takes place? Or is this the U.S. producing a strategy that it plans on using to continue to control the Middle East?
So, that to me is a possibility, because the way I see lighting a match and just letting it blow up, because the way I see Iran in the context of world politics, it comes back to oil to a degree. Because I mean, we in previous episodes we talked about how it is convenient for the U.S. to destabilize Iran and Venezuela, you know, to make sure that the oil prices stay balanced. Mm-hmm. And because again, if these two countries, Venezuela and Iran, Venezuela being the top oil reserves, proven reserves in the world, Iran being in the top five, if these two countries produce at max capacity, the oil prices tank.
Yeah.
And so it's to the benefit of Saudi Arabia and the U.S., the U.S. being the biggest oil producer in the world, to destabilize that region and just say, fuck it, you know, just let them fight it out. They're not going to be able to produce and get their oil in the market.
Right. The countries that rely on Middle Eastern oil is not the United States.
Yeah.
It is China and Europe.
Yeah.
So I think there is some reason to believe that the U.S. is based, it might be that, which is, you know, lighting a match and saying we're out, you know, and we're gonna basically make sure the house begins to burn before we leave. I could see that, because the U.S. is going to have. I mean, there already is calls within the Iraqi government for them to leave their embassy.
And I mean, that leads me to question whether, you know, maybe it's not evident now, but whether their focus will again be on Venezuela being so close. You know, if, you know, as a possible reserve, you know, of being, you know, so close by geographically.
Yes. Well, I will say that. I just think a lot of people have said, oh, the United States has made a mistake here, that the United States has like, or that Trump has gone crazy, or the U.S. state has gone crazy. That thing I don't believe. Mm-hmm. I do think there is something important the U.S. has done here, which is the U.S. had to tolerate their drone being shot out of the sky by Iran without a response. Remember, Trump was about to attack and they didn't. Mm-hmm. There have been tankers supposedly either sunk or almost sunk in that region that they're blaming on Shia forces aligned with Iran. There have been, in Saudi Arabia, there were attacks on oil refineries, supposedly coming from Yemen forces that were, they said, originated from Iran.
They wanted to tie it to Iran desperately. Yes. I mean,
I think maybe, but what the fact is that all these acts happened without the United States responding.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the United States is basically trying to shock the world, is trying to say, we'll do anything. We can get anyone anywhere. We're willing to take out high targets. They want to call this guy a terrorist because, I mean, the claim is that he's trained forces that have been responsible for killing U.S. occupying forces in the throughout Iraq.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting that they're using that. In the past, they've always said terrorists as non-state actors, mm-hmm. right? People who are not aligned with a particular state. Now they're talking about terrorists who are, this is a guy not is a state actor. He's in Iran. Of course, they have Iran being the axis of evil. But what this is the U.S. basically saying, we can touch anyone, and not just touch anyone in among Hezbollah or Hamas mm-hmm. or Osama bin Laden somewhere in a cave. We are willing to hit high-level targets. And that's a message I think they want to send to Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
That's a message they want to send to China, to Russia, that the U.S. is willing to do that. Because China has condemned this, Russia has condemned this, but the U.S. is basically saying, we're willing to do it. And I think Trump is a convenient person mm-hmm. if for the U.S. state to exercise a sort of both a new control mm-hmm. and establish their dominance again militarily, and to sort of get things back on track for themselves, because this is what I think they're trying to do, which is essentially frighten the rest of the world into doing what you're told.
Yeah.
And
I mean, it seems like a game changer a degree. Like you said, it's a bolder action or direct action to enemies at the top, and that the proxies or the mm-hmm. The rogue agents, militias and stuff.
Yeah, and I think you can see the success of it by the 3-day, like what Iran said is they were going to do a 3-day, they're going to do 3 days of mourning. But look, these countries are crooks. All these countries are gangsters. Mm-hmm. One of their major players in their gang just got knocked out by the big gangster. And so the 3-day mourning is not 3-day mourning. It's basically, Iran is basically going, oh, what the F just happened,
sure.
And now they have to figure out how they're going to respond. There will be a response, and the fact is this is not just going to be a response from Iran. There will have to be a response from North Korea. Mm-hmm. There will have to be a response from Russia. There will have to be a response from China.
Yeah.
And what we have to understand is that the U.S., in surprising the world and surprising all of us, is reminding us that this is going to be another decade of surprises.
Yeah.
Because the reason they're doing that is to try to shock their enemies into being cowed.
Mm-hmm.
And their enemies, being these other states, and I will conclude Germany, France, Britain, Russia. I mean, this is the situation. This is how capitalism is constructed. All these people, all these countries are enemies, and they're all competing to who's going to see the biggest slice of the pie and keep it and grow that pie. And if you're not growing that pie, you're losing your pie. And the U.S. is just willing to shock and awe anyone in order to preserve their power. And they don't know where this is going to lead. They don't know what the response Iran will have. They don't know the response Russia will have. But they're basically banking on their response not being as brutal and as risky and as dangerous as theirs.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, that people ask me, they reached out to kind of figure out what was going on. And I was as confused as many other people. And but the one thing I first thought is, like, I don't think conventional war is going to follow from this. The nature of war has changed. It happened under Obama,
mm-hmm.
Through drone strikes, remote, proxy. That's always been the case, proxy war. But, more technological, bombing people from Colorado, and
mm-hmm.
so I don't know. I don't see a scenario where the U.S. will invade, because people were wondering, are we going to invade Iran? That's what some people ask me, and I'm like, I don't think so.
No.
Because that would be a great strategic mistake. I've heard in the past that, Iran is a complete different beast, in terms of, they're more homogeneous, there's not as much sectarian divisions that can be exploited mm-hmm. as it happened in Afghanistan and Iraq. Mm-hmm. Also, the terrain is super difficult, a lot of mountains. They are also 80 million people. They're not a small population by any means. And so, that my first reaction was, I don't think we're going to see the kind of war that, we saw in Afghanistan and Iraq. But definitely my question is, what kind of response is going to come from this? And hearing you, it makes sense, when you use the metaphor of gangsters, right? And if you're under attack, you're gonna get weapons, you're mm-hmm. gonna get ready for battle.
Mm-hmm.
You might not be the aggressor, and the U.S. is the biggest bully here,
mm-hmm.
but you will get ready, and so this will escalate things around the world.
Yes.
Because like you said, this is a message for, you know, people that are stand up to the U.S.
Right. And the only response that you can have if you're also a capitalist power, which Russia is a capitalist power, China is a capitalist power, Iran is a capitalist power of lower stature, if not of that weight, but within that, in that region, the only response you can have is you either accept being cowed, that is, you accept defeat, or you come back with a response that was equally surprising and shocking. And that is where this leads. So, because I do agree that this doesn't immediately mean U.S. troops. There have been talks of 4,000 troops being put on reserve for sending to the Middle East. I don't know what the play is for the United States. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they actually, I mean, I've heard, like I said, I've heard that Iraq is talking about you got to empty out your embassy and get them out, which was also something that happened just before. That was another embarrassment for the United States, which was their embassy was attacked this week.
Yeah.
Again, they were blaming that on Soleimani and Iran. But what this does mean is there has to be, the rest of the other powers aren't going to give up. They aren't going to just accept. They're going to recover. They're going to themselves decide, okay, what is our move here? Mm-hmm. What is our move to make us the winners in this game of maximizing profits, of maximizing resources? And that's the game that's being played. And in order to do that, they have to have their own surprises in store. Surprises for us, mm-hmm. surprises for us, the working class, surprises for the United States, surprises for China, surprises for Russia. Maybe this means Russia does something in the Crimea that weakens, that destabilizes the Ukrainian government. You know, mm-hmm. But they have to take an act. And this is why it's like some people are talking about this guy being killed as like the Archduke Ferdinand when he was assassinated. These are the sorts of moves that I do believe indicate how quickly and how readily things can move from local war, regional war, an act of surgical strike to you don't have a choice any longer. Mm-hmm. And the last sets of, there have been defense documents that I can't remember which website I saw, where there is acceptance among the U.S. ruling class that there's the possibility of using tactical nuclear weapons without losing everything, mm-hmm. you know, and that the same discussion's happening in China, the same discussion's happening in Russia, and so those are the people who are ruling the world right now. Mm-hmm. They are people who can't afford to lose, and who are willing to risk everything and anything to make sure that they win. And that's what that's what's been exposed here. Not Trump's madness, mm-hmm. not the fact that Trump doesn't know what he's doing or the U.S. state doesn't know what he's doing. Like I said, I believe this is an establishment move. I believe the establishment has taken a piece of what Trump is trying to offer, but largely brought him in the game of more global wars, of more regional wars. And you're the guy who's going to help us get our enemies in line. And better than any Democrat right now.
Yeah.
Because I believe the establishment was hoping for Clinton in 2016, and I don't think the establishment has moved away from the Democrats.
And let's remember that she said, you know, that she would bomb Iraq to pieces.
Yes.
You know.
In fact, one of the top Democrat people, I can't remember what his name is, but he's a leading Democrat, one of the defense counsels or something like that. After the embassy got attacked, he was basically saying, we look weak, Trump doesn't have any response.
Right now or Benghazi?
The embassy in Iraq getting attacked. He was criticizing Trump for making the U.S. look so weak. And then Trump does this and he's like, oh my God, what did you just do?
Yeah.
You know, and I do. This is not Trump just being on an all-night bender and suddenly deciding something.
Yeah.
I've heard. Go ahead.
Sorry, and that's when I was reading the response of the Democratic candidates and like Ocasio-Cortez and stuff, and you know, their response, if I summarize it, is, you know, good, but
right.
You know, like, you know, this guy was an evil person. This guy was, you know, a terrorist, but. Basically, they want to paint him as a rogue actor, painting Trump as a rogue actor, you know, that he doesn't have control, that he's, you know, he didn't ask permission from Congress as if, you know.
Yes, and that, well, yes, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, please.
And that's no longer necessary because of the authorization of the use of military forces that was started in 2001. Basically says anytime you call, if you consider somebody a terrorist threat, the president does not need to go to an act of Congress for war. And the authorization for the use of military forces was up for renewal again this time, and the Democrats passed it overwhelmingly again.
Yeah, so very arbitrary use
of
force. Yeah.
They know that Trump doesn't need to do this, and they're certainly not going to tie their own hands when they have their president up there. They're not going to tie their hands with needing to get an act of Congress, because I do think that the U.S. ironically, the defense plans that that came out with Mad Dog Mattis and Trump when mm-hmm. in 2017 when they put forward their proposal for keeping U.S. strong, I can't remember what it was called, really urged about pivoting away from war on terror and moving more towards preparing for larger wars with China mm-hmm. and Russia, and a defense and a military defense that was capable of doing that, which is partly why they were asking for the largest military budget ever this year. Yeah. So I do believe that the U.S. is moving away from war on terror, mm-hmm. but clearly they're going to use that language of terror to then draw in the crosshairs bigger powers that are aligned with Russia and China and let them know that they're next. And they're next in terms of, we're going to undermine your place in the world at your expense so that we can reap the benefits of the resources we need, of the markets we need. We're going to make sure that you are not strong enough to advance your causes. We're going to make sure that your proxies are weak. And if you come after our proxies, we're taking you down. Which is why I do think the U.S. is... I mean, that's what I think it means to go alone, which is we're going to use our relationship with Saudi Arabia and Israel. The United States is going to mm-hmm. use their relationship with Saudi Arabia and Israel to advance their cause in the Middle East. I think it's about Mexico and Colombia in South America. And Britain is the closest thing they have to an ally in the European Union. Britain was critical of this, but, you know, I think the U.S. is going to basically... go it alone, and the folks that think that there's some sort of multilateral collaboration of a community of countries that can rein the United States in and bring them back to, you know, like sanity, that's a myth, because that community doesn't exist. It's a band of hostile brothers, and the only way of ending this is socialist revolution. And there is no solution through Russia, through China, through the United States, through Iran. None of these powers are going to make the world a safer place. Mm-hmm. The only way it's going to be done is the working class, basically, making a revolution.
This country or their countries. And
all those countries are going to have to take down all their governments.
Because, I mean, this is something you said in the past, and that I think it's important that, you know... our own enemy here is our capitalist state. Mm-hmm. The Russians have their own enemy in their Russian capitalist state. Venezuelans have their own enemy in their, you know, the capitalist state. And, you know, yeah. And so our work is to conquer political power, mm-hmm. working class democracy, and decision making.
Yeah. We're far away from that. Yeah. And I think some of the things I've heard from the left that has been critical of this has been thinking that this is Israel or Saudi Arabia getting the United States to do this.
Oh,
what do you make of that?
I haven't heard those things in the bit that I've read and stuff.
Because they're saying Netanyahu is
lobbying or influencing.
Yeah, and is risking not being reelected, mm-hmm. and that this event actually plays for his reelection. And sort of the idea here that people who I've read and who I have respected, I do respect. Mm-hmm. This is people in the gray zone and things like this. This guy Max Blumenthal, basically saying that Israel is basically controlling the United States in this region and getting them to do their bidding, because he's basically saying Trump, this doesn't help the United States, and it mostly helps Israel.
Okay.
And I personally think they've got it backwards.
Yeah,
that there's no way Israel wags the tail of Israel wags the U.S. dog. Mm. That the U.S. is the dominant power in the globe, and Israel knows that, and Israel is counting on using its relationship with them to maintain their usefulness and their military presence as a colonial settler state in that region, as an apartheid state, and now they've got an even tighter alliance now with the United States by virtue of this sort of go it alone strategy that the Trump is doing, and I think the establishment of the U.S. state is endorsing in taking this action up. Because, like you said, while there is criticism of, like, hey, you didn't consult us, are you sure you want to do this? Overall, there's an overall agreement that something had to be done.
I mean, that it was a good thing that it was done. But, you know, there is no, you know, this shouldn't have, this should have never happened, you know. This should have maybe happened differently, but.
You
know, and this is a bad guy, but, you know. But he's a rogue. Again, they bring it back to, I think, the political cycle. You know, the Democratic candidates, at least, you know, they all at least fall in line with that whole idea of making Trump seem out of control. And as if he doesn't know what he's doing.
And I do think, like, some people have also said that this is Trump trying to distract from the impeachment.
I've heard that argument,
What do you think of that?
I'm not sure. I actually wanted to ask you that. I mean, it definitely is the biggest news. It's caught people's attention more than the impeachment. Like, you know, a lot of people have that don't usually engage in politics. This definitely, like, stirred something in them, in friends, you know, family, whatever, that, you know, they all rolled their eyes when it, you know, talk of impeachment comes up, you know, but this catches their attention for sure. I'm not sure. What do you think? I mean, I don't think is the main, you know, you wouldn't take such a bold step to, you know, just to win an election. I mean, I do think that war tends to help, you know, get reelected, especially if your country is perceived under threat. But I think the U.S. here is, you know, is obviously the aggressor. It's, oh, it always is, but, you know, I don't think... So my concern is for the future, after this happened, it's any other possible acts of violence being blamed on Iran, you know, for a possible excuse, know, and to escalate even more. So, but I mean, that's why I bring up the fact that I don't think the U.S. would want to go into Iran, but definitely, I don't know.
First, the dude, the defense, the new defense who replaced Mad Dog Mattis, his last name is Espy. I don't know his first name. Maybe it's Nathaniel. He basically said, yeah, we know that Iran's going to respond, but they're going to regret anything they do. Like, he's basic. I mean, and this is like, this is the language of Pompeo. This is the language of Espy. This is not just Trump. I mean, these are these are deep state people talking, you know. So clearly a part of the establishment has digested what has been done and puts the stamp of approval and authorized it. And in fact, you know, possibly came to the Trump and said, we can act now, let's do it. Because we have to, we can no longer be the embarrassment to, as the global empire that's being embarrassed around the globe by Iran. And that makes us, that makes the United States look weak. And they're right, you can't do that. If you're, in this game, you cannot be perceived as weak. That's how capitalism makes it. Now, in terms of, is this, so I don't believe, well, I do believe it is related to the impeachment in this way. Because I used to think of the, I thought the Ukraine stuff was all about the elections. Like, it was just electioneering, just trying to, who's going to win the election. But I have come to see or believe that there really is a policy difference around challenging Russia. And this act does challenge Russia. This act is exactly in line with the people who are authors of Ukrainegate and using, trying to impeach Trump on the basis of him being a Manchurian candidate for Putin, or for him trying to weaken Ukraine. This is a, this is basically exactly what they wanted. Now they're saying they don't want it, but this is what they've been pushing for in trying to impeach this guy. And I think the impeachment has been effective. I think impeachment has corralled him into saying, I've got to play a little bit of ball here. Because I actually think in terms of Trump getting elected, he was, the popularity of the impeachment was really low. Like, there was a spike for it, and then people were just saying, this is bullshit. And so Trump could have, in many ways, people could have said Trump could have won the election and then done this thing after he wins the election. Because I think it was a slam dunk. I actually think Trump has put his election at risk by doing this, but he's done it because I think there are bigger powers within the state who are saying we have to take this move, and they've basically got him.
How does he put his election at risk?
Because the one thing, the one part of his base, there's a part of his base that really felt like he was the anti-war candidate. Mm-hmm. That who was angry about Syria, angry when he did that, but has all, but and we're supported him when he went, we're going to do a half pullout of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. We're doing a full pullout of Syria. They were like, yes, this is what we wanted, things like this. So I think he has risked an element of his base. Mm-hmm. among workers or people who support him. Now, ironically, I've been checking some of these people who on the right who have been critical of him in the past just to see where are they landing on this thing. And honestly, Tucker Carlson was critical of this, but didn't want to say Trump's name. Didn't want to say, he was saying, look what the state has done. This is wrong. Look what the U.S. state has done. They've just made war more likely. Mm-hmm. But he's trying to act like Trump didn't have anything to do with it. Mm-hmm. And other people who were critical of what he did in Syria are basically saying, yeah, he should do this.
Has he even spoken to me about this?
Tucker Carlson?
No, Trump.
Okay. Trump is, he basically came out and said, I'm not trying to make more war. I'm trying to end war by basically, getting rid of a criminal like this, giving it with a person who is trying to make war on U.S. Soldiers, not saying that these soldiers are actually right on the border of Iran, not saying that these soldiers are occupying countries that they shouldn't be in, but basically saying he is threatening U.S. soldiers abroad or anywhere. So that's where his accusation of this guy being a terrorist is. So it's in line with the language around ISIS, with the language around the war on terror, with the language around Osama bin Laden, and now they're using terror language to go after directly after states. Mm-hmm.
So going back to his re-election, you were saying that there's a part of his base that looked at him as a weak, representative in terms of taking the war right to the world, or
who basically saw. I mean, Trump in the past has tweeted things critical of Obama for being in Iraq. Trump said he would have never gone to Iraq. He was saying we have to get out. And there are people who thought he was the president to get us out of these regions and to stop endless war and to stop regime change.
Okay. Yeah.
And clearly he's not.
Yeah.
For me, the silver lining here is that I've had problems with what I think the left has been unprincipled about this stuff. Supporting Obama or, non-socialists in socialist colors to provide, for whatever reason. And what I see on the right is an equally unprincipled right. That is that I think a lot of these people who were on the right who were screaming about Syria but aren't now upset about this are worried about Trump losing in November. So they don't want to say anything.
Yeah.
And so instead they're supporting Trump on it. And so the fact that the right wing is as unprincipled as the left wing, to me, I take some solace in that. In that, none of these sides are going to have anything principled or even anything strong that they can offer the working class. So that's just my kind of pet project thinking when I think about these things. So it's just a side thought that I have, which is that the right is as effed up as the left is, and that's a good thing because. I think because the right has been rising all around the world, there is no real international principle. There is no real principle of peace that exists within the right because it's all nationalist. But unfortunately, the left has had nothing to offer people and has only offered people lies. And so I think now we see that the right wing is also offering only lies. Mm-hmm. That's a good thing for those of us who want to build the left.
I mean, at least in this country, right? The right in this country.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Is that it, maybe?
Maybe. Any other thoughts?
Any other thoughts from you about this?
I don't know. I mean, what do you expect Iran? What do you see as a part, this playing out? How would they respond? I mean, I know it's a big question, but...
What these forces will do immediately, I don't know. I do believe that, to me, what this shows is, again, that the immediate, the it's unfortunate Eduardo's not here because in our COP 25 episode, he was like, Andy, why do you always bring it back to U.S. imperialism? Why do you always talk about the war? You know, we're talking here about the environment. And events like this should be a reminder of why, like, the environment is being destroyed by capitalism. And it's a faster process at times, slower process at other times. But the speed with which the world could be destroyed so that humans really can't live on it can happen in weeks.
Yeah.
That's what this event shows to me. Because the one thing I can say is that unless these people, these criminals who run this system are stopped, they are going to have a world war. The next thing isn't U.S. invading Iran, but this will eventually lead to some sort of escalation from some other actor that the U.S. will have to respond to if it feels it's threatened. And we have to understand there's nothing they're not willing to do. There's nothing stopping them except to say that they need to do something that will terrify their opponent into believing this is a line you can't cross. And I don't think there's no line for them. There's no line for the United States. No. There's no line for China. There's no line for Russia. There's no line for Britain. There's no line for Germany. There's no line for any capitalist because their only thing they have to be dedicated to is profits and their continued growth as a national power to preserve and expand on those profits. And if the U.S. is getting over on them, then they have to take some sort of step to counter that. So where they act to do that, I can't know because I don't know how all the different parts of the different powers have their fingers in different pies. I know the U.S. is everywhere, you know, and so what countries that are directly in competition with the U.S. will do to respond now, not sure, but I know they have to respond. And they have to respond in a way that puts fear into the United States. And if they put fear in the United States, then we have to know that the United States will respond in a way that then goes back and puts fear in their opponent.
Escalation.
There is no alternative to that.
I mean, that's one of the aspects of, like, weapons, right? Nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, why Iran and North Korea are pursuing some of this stuff, because if you're under a constant attack, you know, you have to have something big enough to scare people away.
Right.
You know, hammer.
Which is why the only solution to this, there's no solution other than international socialist revolution, a working class dictatorship internationally. And the only way to get there is through strikes and general strikes and then workers' councils set up across countries and then ultimately uniting in a common cause of worker solidarity to run the globe.
Yeah, because right now the response, we'll see protests, you know, anti-war protests, and I don't know, if obviously I don't believe that is does anything really, but if we were to go plan strikes, you know, in order for our government to stop doing this shit, you know, to get him out of power, because they're not doing our bidding, they're doing their own bidding.
Right.
You know.
Well, here's the thing. On December, what's today? December?
January 4th.
January 3rd, or 4th.
4th, 2020.
Tomorrow is the 5th, and on the 6th, we have our first day of school.
Yeah.
We're going to go to work, and our union's going to go to work. Teachers will go to work. Teachers will go to work across the country. And the only way we could send a message to really stop and maybe get the United States to rethink this is if we didn't.
No.
And that's it. Like the idea that there's a demonstration on Saturday that would happen that's going to make a difference. Now we had the million person march in Iraq and stuff like that, and those are fine in terms of sentiment. But first of all, sentiment has been etched away by Obama and the Democratic Party, and I think now people who one of the complaints people are making about bombing Iran is like, hey, wait. They were our ally in fighting ISIS. So once you say that, then you've already bought into the U.S. war. Once you've said, hey, wait a second, you just got our ally. You just got our ally against ISIS. Well, that's not a good thing. Then you already bought into the whole war on terror. So when you have a left wing that's saying shit like that, you don't have a left wing that can be anti-imperialist. Because they've already bought into the war on terror. That's the language of the war on terror.
Yeah.
So this the U.S. anti-war movement is almost non-existent. There will be a demonstration, so there might be demonstrations, sizable demonstrations throughout the city, mm-hmm. but they offer no challenge to what the U.S. is doing. And even the millions and millions of people who came in this country back in the war in Iraq and the ones that were internationally could not offer a challenge. The only way we're going to stop this is stopping capitalism and putting fear into the capitalists about them second guessing themselves. Not just the fear that the U.S. capitalists shouldn't just have fear of Russian capitalists. They won't really stop this or won't really be put on notice until they fear the U.S. working class.
Yeah, I mean, when we're talking about weapons in response, I mean, that is our ultimate weapon, right? As working class, the ability to strike and bring
production to a halt.
Yeah, to a halt, yeah. And I mean, you can wave, and beg, basically. That's how I see protests, begging, you know, the ruling class to change their mind. Maybe we'll jump in. Slightly different question about being a socialist, you know. So say we have a socialist revolution in this country. Then we have to fight, you know, these other powers, right?
Yeah.
You know, this is something that comes up. You know, I hear this anxiety from people that, you know, have questions about socialism. So if it's not us, then someone else will do it. What would you say to that?
I'm not sure.
Also, if it's not us ruling the world, you know, there are, you know, China's knocking at the door, you know, applying for being in the empire.
Yes.
Russia being applying for the same job. So if it's not, if we are distracted, or at least this is how I perceive it, you know, some people say, we are, so aren't they a threat to our revolution?
Yes. The Chinese capitalists, the Russian capitalists would then, they would be in this bind. They would have the benefit of seeing the U.S. empire crumble, literally, mm-hmm. and then they would see that as an opportunity, no question. At the same time, a revolution that happens among the workers mm-hmm. in this country is definitely going to have resonance for workers in China and workers in Russia, who themselves are facing their own ruling classes.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question will become, can the revolution that takes place in the United States, if it did,
mm-hmm.
which I don't think it will start here, but let's say it did, or let's say it came to the United States and China and Russia hadn't fallen in their own revolution, then it is a race against time about will the Chinese ruling workers take down their government?
Mm-hmm.
If they don't do that, and the U.S. working class is left isolated among Europe, among mm-hmm. Russia, among China, then that revolution will not last. That revolution will find itself in the situation that it found itself, that the Russians found themselves in, which is an isolate. Now, we will last way longer because the working class is much stronger. The United States has more resources within it that the working class could use to sustain itself and to keep a real working class democracy that means people are fed and housed. Because if you can't do that, you can't have working class democracy.
No.
And if that you lose that, it turns out, I believe, you do lose the possibility of socialism.
Yeah.
And if the revolution can be starved so that democracy is no longer sustainable, then the capitalists win. And that will be the goal. But they'll be doing it simultaneously at the same time. They'll be, oh, good, we lost an enemy, but we've gained the possibility of revolution taking place in our country. And that's really what the United States faced when Russia went down.
Mm-hmm.
Russia and France were allies with... I mean, United States and France were allies with Russia in World War I, fighting Germany and the other powers there. And suddenly, one of their powers went out of the game and went down. And then Germany was not the big problem any longer. Then Russia became the big problem at that point. So United States at that point was willing to kind of like put aside their problems with Germany and go after Russia and try to basically lead proxy wars to take down that government. Because they felt a bigger threat than even Germany was the working class revolution that which had just taken place in Russia. And ultimately, the civil war that they helped provoke was successful in strangling the revolution, keeping it isolated. The revolution did not spread, nearly spread to Germany. We nearly had a revolution mm-hmm. in Germany. And had that happened, that could have been that domino effect, which the capitalists would worry about. So that is the game. The game is... international socialism will have to spread. If it doesn't, capitalism can regain itself. And I don't know if China, feels like it has to nuke the newly formed workers' councils in the United States, or what was previously the United States, but now is the United Working Class of whatever. But that's kind of beyond our control. The only thing we ultimately can control is what we do in this country, and can we make a revolution happen that we would want to act as a light for other workers? Fighting those capitalists, taking the bomb out of their hand, I don't think we're going to be in a position to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to be counting on workers in China
to do that themselves.
I mean, there were things built like the what's called the Comintern, the Communist International, various parties forming to try to work together to try to spread the revolution. But there were also actions that the Soviet Union took to try to invade Poland in the 20s to try to impose, you know, the revolution in that way. That to me, that's you can't do it. That doesn't work. You know,
I mean, at that point, it's a different type of revolution. It's not, right. You know.
And closer to what you do is what they did when they were fighting, Russia fought Germany, which is essentially give up territory, mm-hmm. in making peace with Germany to get out of World War I, and basically making that appeal to German workers, we're not willing to fight you. That's the only appeal the working class can make after its revolution, from my vantage point at least, is to say, we're not going to fight you on any... We refuse to fight other German workers, other Chinese workers, or other Russian workers, and we're making this appeal for you to do the same and take down your government because they're going to force you to fight us. Beyond that, I don't think there's much we can do. That's my answer.
Yeah. Great.
So, all right. I think we're done for today.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Kenny.
Thank you
for being willing to meet and talk about Iran and socialism. Next week, I think we'll be doing the episode with Eduardo, and we're going to talk about the Yellow Vests. Maybe something will take place in the world within a week. We'll see. And if you've enjoyed this episode, then you can see this episode on iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher,
Google Play,
BitChute. I should know this. I'm the person who sets this up. And if you've liked this episode or if you want to see other episodes, please subscribe or review any of our episodes, you know, write a review for us on iTunes, and certainly make comments for anything you've thought about what you've listened to today. Eduardo does such a much better job of ending the episode.
Yeah. I mean, he's young.
I can do some things, but this...
Technology is not your
first aid. But anyway, thank you for joining us, and anything else you want to say?
No, I mean, I just hope that this is starts conversations, you know. I think it's important to ask questions, and, you know, I'm happy that people have engaged around me about this. Like, I don't have the answers, but by knowing the fundamentals of empire and power, capitalism, you kind of can, you know, put some of the pieces together and have a sense. At the very least, I would say don't take the news at face value.
Right. And I would say that is why we want to do this episode, which is we are hoping people are having conversations like this to say, what the hell are we going to do to take back our world?
Yeah. You know? And it is our world.
Because apparently the other people, these capitalists, are prepared to burn it.
And you can beg them, you know?
Yeah. All right. So see you next week. And I guess that's it. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.